Welcome to the Autonicast. I'm Ed Niedermeyer. With me, as always, is Mr. Alex Roy. Alex, how are you?
I'm terrific. I'm Alex Roy, your editor-at-large for The Drive. And today we have another very special episode. We have with us Chairman Christopher Hart of the National Transportation Safety Board, someone I've wanted to talk to and interview for the longest time. Chairman Hart, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. Let me just put a correction in there that I'm not chairman anymore. It's a political appointment. My term as chairman expired in March. I am now a member of the NTSB and no longer chairman.
And so what would be the correct way of referring to you? Member Hart?
Member Hart is correct.
Terrific. Member Hart has written a fascinating article, which will be available on thedrive.com. The title of it is Automation on Our Streets and Highways, Lessons Learned from Automation in Aviation. And this is something that is really core to the Autonicast, because Ed and I have been talking about the relationship between aviation and ground transportation and automation for a very, very long time. So we will provide a link to the article, which will be published, I think, before this airs, so everyone can read it. So let's get started. Member Hart, could you give us a little bit of your background and how you came to join the NTSB?
Oh, thank you. And thank you at the outset for having me, because this is quite an opportunity to help spread the word about how much a believer I am in automation in cars and how important it is to really do it the right way the first time. So thank you for the opportunity to come and talk about it. I'm here at the NTSB because a number of reasons. One is my mother told me the first thing she ever saw me draw was an airplane. So I'm an airplane addict, and I'm a pilot, and I have, my degree is in aerospace engineering. And after I got my aerospace engineering degree, I went to law school. So I have the opportunity here at the NTSB to combine my careers and do legal issues and engineering issues and pilot issues, and it's a dream job for me. So this is a great place to be. I was appointed to be vice chairman by President Obama in 2009, and in 2014 I became acting chairman. 2015 I became chairman, and that chairman term is a 2-year term, and that expires in the end of March. So I am now a member of the NTSB. So I came here because I love airplanes and I love transportation, and as a pilot and someone who drives and someone who rides the trains and someone who uses transportation, I'm fascinated and very interested in transportation safety. So that's kind of in a brief nutshell how I came here in the first place.
A lot of people are confused about the relationship between the Department of Transportation, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, and the NTSB. Where does the NTSB's mandate start and end?
Okay, that's a good question. I get that a lot. The NTSB is an accident investigator. So we investigate accidents to determine what went wrong, and then we make recommendations to prevent that from happening again. We do not have any authority to require anything. That authority is in the regulator. That's what the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is. They are the regulator. They are the ones who promulgate regulations to say what cars must have, and trucks and buses too, but they can require things to be done. We are the investigator when things go wrong. We don't require. Instead, we issue recommendations as to what should be done to try to prevent those accidents from happening again.
And unlike NHTSA, you also have a mandate that covers more than just automobiles, if that's right. Also airplanes and trains.
That's correct. We look at all modes of transportation. Aviation is probably the biggest, but we also do highway, we do rail, we do cruise ships, we do pipelines even. So anything that moves, Congress wanted us to figure out if something goes wrong, why did it go wrong, and what can we do to prevent it from happening again?
Yeah, so I'm wondering, you know, with the advent of automated driving, are you focusing more on road vehicle safety than before, sort of in response to this new technological era?
Most of our highway investigations have involved large vehicles, trucks, and motor coaches with commercial drivers. Very rarely do we investigate accidents involving Joe or Susie Public and their car. The first one that we're investigating that's going to come across my desk as a board member is the one we're investigating now, the Tesla accident that occurred in Williston, Florida, and we'll be actually having the public meeting to decide what the cause of that accident was on September 12th. So that's coming up quickly. But that's the first time that an accident of that type has come across my desk, and that is precisely because we are very interested in the impacts of automation on the highways.
So going back in time, I mean, that's a very precipitous and fascinating thing. But going back in time to the origins of the NTSB, what was the event or series of accidents that led to the I guess, the beginnings of the NTSB?
Actually, that's interesting you asked that, because this year is our 50th anniversary year. So we've been around since 1967, and it was the origin of it actually starts with aviation accident investigation, and that started with the Department of Commerce in 1926, and then the Civil Aeronautics Board. And the attempt in 1967 in creating the NTSB was to bring all of the modes together so that we would be investigating transportation accidents in all modes of transportation and not just aviation.
So automation and the pros and cons and consequences of it has always been at the core of what the NTSB is doing.
I wouldn't necessarily say the core. I would just say that automation, as it has been implemented in aviation, because they're by far, of all of the modes that we're looking at, they're by far in the lead regarding implementing automation. So many of the accidents that we're seeing are automated in aviation, are automation related. So that's how we have acquired our expertise regarding automation in transportation. It's mostly in aviation. We also see it in ships. We see it in trains. We see it in managing pipelines. So there is automation in all the modes that we're looking at, but aviation has advanced it the most.
In your piece, you say automation is a double-edged sword. There could be good and bad, but you also say automation is not working as intended. Could you maybe explain sort of your thinking behind that?
Well, what I was referring to was that there are situations in which automation doesn't work as intended. So I wasn't saying that as a general matter, it doesn't work as intended. And quite the contrary, as a general matter, automation is having an amazing positive impact on efficiency and throughput and reliability and safety and all of the positive measures. What we're saying is it's a double-edged sword. There is a downside to that. So automating isn't as easy as people think. The theory is, if you just remove the human, you remove the human error. So that's the theory. Well, the reality is a little more complicated than that.
Boeing and Airbus began adding real automation in the late 70s and early 80s. And there were accidents or crashes that occurred overseas that did not involve, you know, Americans or American airliners. For example, there was the early Airbus crash, I believe it was near, it was a demonstration flight. It was one of the first Airbuses, and there was a test pilot on board. Was the NTSB at all involved in analyzing those early automation crashes?
That crash you're talking about was at the Paris Air Show, and we were not involved in investigating that crash. The way that it works in terms of who gets involved in investigating is there's an international treaty that was established through the International Civil Aviation Organization, which is ICAO. That's the aviation branch of the United Nations. And by international treaty, we have a treaty right to be involved in international investigation if there's a significant American interest. So that would typically mean American airliner, an American-built airplane, American-built engines, American-built, American-made avionics, a lot of American passengers. Anything that gives us a significant American interest enables us to, gives us a legal right to participate in international accidents. In addition to that, we're often asked, because of the world-class expertise of our investigators, we're often asked to participate even when we don't have an international treaty right to be there.
I'm wondering, because NTSB has this deep experience looking at aviation and also specifically sort of the impacts of automation on safety and in these various crashes and accidents, how do you apply your knowledge that you've gained up about aviation safety and automation and sort of use that to start anticipating and addressing some of the safety issues you see coming with the proliferation of automation in vehicle driving?
Mostly the automation, the way we feedback into the automation world is through our recommendations after an accident. We also can do safety studies. If we wanted to do a safety study focused on a specific issue, that can result in recommendations, and sometimes those recommendations address automation as well. But as accident investigators, we are normally going to be speaking out on automation if automation played a role in the accident that we're investigating. That's the primary way that we would speak out. And by the way, I forgot to mention, let me add that even though we only make recommendations and can't require anything, more than 80% of the time, our recommendations are considered so good that people do them even though they don't have to.
With the rise of automation in aircraft, there are these two schools of thought that Ed and I have discussed. You have the Airbus school and you have the Boeing school. And I can try to explain them, I guess, as simply as possible, but I'd love you to correct me if I'm wrong. As I understand it, in an Airbus, you have these flight envelope protections, which limit the ability of the pilot with certain control inputs. And assuming the hardware and software is working perfectly, the plane is theoretically uncrashable. Whereas in a Boeing, when you hit the limits of the performance envelope, the pilot can push through the stick shaker or any warnings. And so my question is, Is there any significant difference between the number of crashes that occur with the Airbus approach versus the Boeing approach?
Actually, your description of it is fairly close. The way I would describe it at a very high level is that the Airbus automation is set up so that it will tell you that something is going wrong, but then it won't let you do whatever you would do to make it get worse. Whereas the Boeing automation will tell you that something is going wrong, but then it will let you take the next step. And the difference in that philosophy is that Airbus believes that their software designers can appropriately define the envelope of activity, whereas Boeing believes that the software designers may not have appropriately defined the envelope of activity, and therefore they allow the pilots to go beyond that envelope if the pilot feels that it's necessary in the moment. So there is a significant difference in the automation theory. The outcome of it is that the FAA has never pronounced one over the other, and that's because they both have their pluses and minuses, but there is a significant difference in the automation theory, and I'm not aware of any statistical difference between them in terms of which theory has shown to be most accident prone.
In my effort to research that, I also, it would appear that statistically they are about the same in terms of crash rates, but I would have to assume that the crash types then become different when you do, the NTSB does its investigation. Is that true?
Not necessarily, because I can give you accidents in all kinds of modes of operation, both in Boeing and Airbus. And so, again, both automation philosophies have their pluses and minuses, and that's why there is no proclamation from any regulator that one is better than the other, because they both have good sides and they both have bad sides. The concern that Boeing had was there is the possibility that whoever designed the limits of the software may not have been able to anticipate the circumstances that software is going to encounter, whereas the pilot will be able to respond to that in the moment. Certainly, you don't want big airplanes encountering an aerodynamic stall, for example. So both of them have their ways of preventing that, but the Boeing way is different than the Airbus way, but we have still seen aerodynamic stalls in both types of airplanes. So I would not say that one type of automation is inherently better than the other. They both have their pluses and minuses.
Your article, which is absolutely fascinating and is a real dose of fresh air in this whole dialogue, talks a lot about human factors and the difference between a human in on the loop versus human removed from the loop. Last week, we interviewed Gil Pratt from Toyota Research Institute, and he was talking about the different types of automation in cars, which mirror the Airbus and Boeing approach, and he defined them as parallel autonomy, which is the approach that they're following, and series autonomy, which is the approach that most automotive manufacturers are following. Why do you suppose the entire automotive sector has followed what appears to a series autonomy approach in semi-autonomous levels like level 3, as opposed to a parallel approach, which would more closely resemble what has seemed to have worked in aviation?
That's a good question, but I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with those terms. Can you help me define what those two mean?
You know, something you've just highlighted, a critical problem of auto development in ground transportation, is that they're not using the nomenclature which has been defined over decades, by organizations like the NTSB. So if you look at Tesla Autopilot or Mercedes Drive Pilot, or pretty much almost every car manufacturer, as they develop semi-autonomous technologies underneath level 4, like level 3, the human is in the car, he engages the system, and then stops paying attention. The system is driving the car. And then with minimal to no warning, there may be they may have to take over control. That would be a series type system where the more automation increases, the less the human's involved. And Toyota's approach is a parallel system where the human is always controlling the vehicle, but always has a safety net to ready to take over if the human stops guiding the vehicle. That seems to me to be closer to the Airbus type system, but these vagaries are really the problem. The nomenclature is different between ground and aviation, and the approaches, they don't line up with what we know works in aircraft.
Thank you for that description of the two terms. I'll do some research on that to understand them more extensively, but I can think of examples of both of those in aviation where I've seen series situations and parallel situations in aviation.
The key issue is the driver, the human driver, the primary driver engaged in the task with the computer there to back them up? Or is the computer the primary agent in the driving task with the human there to back them up? That's sort of the most simple contrast between the two. One of the sort of questions that surrounds this question between these two different approaches is the issue of skill degradation. Is there evidence to suggest that these automation systems that put the system first and the human as a backup, are these associated with skill degradation? Is that an issue that the NTSB is looking at or concerned about?
You raised several issues that I refer to in my article, and the skills degradation is certainly one of them. That's the example that I referred to in the article is the crash of Asiana Airlines in San Francisco in 2014, I believe it was, and that was one where it was it should have been a non-event. It was a beautiful, clear day with negligible wind and a big 11,000-foot runway, which was more than what they needed, but the automation was not working because the electronic guidance to the runway was down for maintenance. Normally, most pilots would use the electronic guidance and they would hook their automation to the electronic guidance and it would take the airplane to the runway and even in the more advanced airplanes would even land the airplane. So when automation is so good, then that certainly presents a possibility for degradation of skills. And that's what happened in Asiana was that the pilot was not able to manually execute this landing, which should have been a non-event on an 11,000-foot runway and crashed short of the runway and hit the seawall. So that was definitely a skills degradation. It was also, there are several other issues that come up in that accident. For example, when the automation is not doing what it's supposed to do, it needs to let the operator know that in time for the operator to recover with sufficient time to, you know, recover successfully from the problem that's developing. Asiana was not an example of the automation not working, but it was an example of the automation not doing what the pilot thought it was doing because the pilot thought that his automatic throttle was controlling his airspeed. So he selected an airspeed and he thought the automatic throttle was maintaining that airspeed, but it wasn't, and he wasn't aware of that. So, and that there are lots of reasons why that happened, but the point is that the automation didn't do what he wanted it to do. It didn't fail. It did what it was designed to do, but it didn't do what he wanted it to do, and he didn't understand that it wasn't doing what he wanted to do. And because of his skills degradation and his lack of familiarity with that airplane and not knowing that his speed was not being automatically maintained, then he got behind the power curve on that and crashed into the seawall. So several of those issues that you mentioned are referred to in my article because we've seen them all in aviation. And we will probably still see even more of it. So that mode confusion is a very real problem in automation that the person needs to know exactly what the automation is doing.
Is this an issue that can be addressed with training with human machine interface, or is it really both, or is there another way to address this kind of crash?
Fundamentally, it's a design issue because training is always a key part of the equation, but training is one of the least effective ways to improve safety because training has to be continuous. It has to be recurrent. It can be forgotten in the moment. There are lots of concerns about training. As essential as it is, it's still the weakest part of the system. The more robust part of the system is to design the system better so that less training is necessary. So it's a combination of a design challenge and a training challenge.
Member Hart, has the NTSB ever issued a report or recommendations regarding the design of HMI to reduce mode confusion?
The accidents that we have investigated, to the extent we saw mode confusion and design inadequacies that led to mode confusion, then we have issued recommendations to address them, yes, including in the Asiana crash.
Is there a standardization between Airbus, Boeing, and other aircraft manufacturers regarding to resolve mode confusion in terms of displays or warnings?
There are so many variations on the theme in terms of the types of automation and what they're doing and what they're not doing that I would say as a general matter, no, there is not standardization on it. People are learning from each other, but there's no like agreed upon meeting. Why don't we all do it this way? There's not standardization in that respect, but they exchange lessons learned very freely on what works in automation and what doesn't. But I would not describe that as standardization. It would just people are trying to learn from each other.
Has the NTSB ever issued recommendations regarding driver's education? I mean, you've covered trucking accidents, and so obviously commercial trucking licenses require different training. Is that something you guys work on?
I believe we have issued recommendations regarding driver training, but I couldn't give you chapter and verse. We've issued recommendations on things like graduated licensing and things like that. We've seen the crash rate go up considerably when there are multiple teenagers in the car versus just one if there's no adult in the car. So we do have a number of recommendations on issues like that, but I'd have to get back to you with the specifics.
Before we dive into the really fun part of your article, which is great, are you familiar with a stillborn attempt in the 70s to create a master driver's license for civilians in the United States?
No, I'm not familiar with that attempt.
Well, that's too bad because I've been trying to learn more about it. And apparently a couple of congressmen and someone from DOT attended racing school to investigate whether racing licenses should become, and those standards should be applied to normal people. It's very hard to find anything about that.
Let me just tell you why I would doubt if we have much in that arena, because we try not to be prescriptive. We want to be very high level and say what needs to be fixed, but not be prescriptive about how to fix it, because the more prescriptive we get, then the more likely we are to end up investigating an accident where someone followed our prescription, and then our objectivity is compromised because we're in effect investigating our own prescription. So we try to stay out of saying how to fix something. We try to stay at a high level and issue recommendations about what needs to be fixed, but not how.
That's really fascinating. I'm wondering, you know, you mentioned earlier the amount of information sharing that happens in the aviation business, and sort of the sense that, you know, one plane crash can affect every manufacturer, and it's in their interest to pool resources to study problems and to create solutions. I'm wondering what level of that exists in the auto space, sort of the private car space, and is that something that you think there maybe needs to be more of going forward as we enter this sort of increasingly semi-automated world?
There's a very different dynamic in the auto industry, because another way to state what I just said about anybody's crash is anybody's accident is everybody's accident. Another way to state that is that the airlines do not compete in safety. So you never see an airline ad that says we are the safest airline out there. And the reason they don't compete in safety as a practical matter is that they are statistically indistinguishable. I mean, if you look at long distance carriers, for example, the carriers that serve the long routes, you're going to find that their accident rates are statistically indistinguishable. So they do not compete on safety. And that's a very different dynamic than in the car world, where they compete vigorously on safety and do in their ads mention our car is the safest one out there. And so that is a very different dynamic in the two industries. My expectation is that because of the intense competition on safety, hopefully it can be converted into a marketing effort to help increase the penetration rate of safety devices, because people want safety in their cars. And so that I would think that the car industry competing on safety is actually a plus, in the sense that it can leverage the marketing forces to help increase the penetration rate of safety devices.
There was a meeting about a year and change ago at the Swedish embassy in Washington, in which several car manufacturers, and specifically Volvo, were present and were debating the pros and cons of information sharing between car manufacturers as they research autonomy. So number of disengagements, types of disengagements. And Alan Kornhauser from Princeton, I believe he suggested that something like Robert Oppenheimer suggested after World War II, that everyone should share all their information to make the world a better place. And he was laughed down by some of the car manufacturers present, who considered any information they have regarding technological advances and safety to be proprietary, you know, competitive information. They did not want to share it. So it seems like there needs to be a very big cultural shift in the automotive sector if we're actually going to see safety improve.
Well, maybe and maybe not. That's why I say that the sharing that occurs in the airline industry, I'm not sure that concept is transferable to the car industry. And I wonder if, because of the competition in the car industry, to the extent they can leverage that competition to help encourage people to buy safety devices in their cars and help increase the penetration rate, query whether it's actually better to depend on that competition rather than requiring the sharing of proprietary information. I don't have an answer to that yet. We don't have a good market example of how that works. We just know that in aviation, because anybody's crash is everybody's crash, that sharing inures to everybody's benefit. I'm not sure that the same is true in the car industry.
Well, I would definitely agree that competition, especially on the low level of automation, you know, AEB and forward collision warning and lane keep assist and things like that, I think we are seeing competition there. We are seeing more automakers push those technologies, you know, down to their more affordable cars. And there's no doubt that has to have a great effect on safety going forward. But I wonder also if part of this competition is not purely about safety. I think rhetorically safety is invoked a lot around automation. But I think one of the things I see is companies sort of seeing an opportunity to market autonomous or self-driving technology or technologies that make the experience feel like it's autonomous or self-driving, when in fact it's maybe a level 3 or level 2 system. It seems to me that the demand that they're filling is not necessarily that people really, really want a safer car, although a lot of them do. But I think a lot of people really want a car that feels like it's self-driving. So is it possible that some of this competition is maybe not purely focused just on making the car safer, but is also about creating the perception that there's this futuristic autonomous drive system on the car? And then the other sort of follow-up to that is, you know, to what extent do you look at sort of communications that these automakers make about the capabilities of their vehicles? You know, how do you draw connections between those communications and sort of how people use those vehicles potentially in an unsafe way?
Well, you get to a point that's also addressed in the article, which is relates to the fact that in aviation and in their early automation history, they were automating because they had the technology to do it. And it wasn't necessarily just for safety reasons. It was for safety and efficiency and productivity and, you know, lots of the positive parameters that you would want. But they discovered through hard experience that automating just because you can doesn't necessarily make the human machine system work better. And what evolved from that was what's called human-centric automation, where it's not just automate because you have the technology to do it, but instead it's automate because this makes the human machine system work better. So that's a very different phenomenon. And where I see the car makers at this point is automating because they can do it. And that includes not only safety, but it also includes other convenience items. So, you know, one example would be the example I heard that you can get out of your Tesla and have it park itself while you're in the restaurant, and then you can beckon it and it'll come and pick you up. So that's not a safety issue. That's a, you know, that's a convenience issue. But that's an example of automating because we can. The question is, does that make the human machine system work better?
As far as communication about the capabilities of these systems, I mean, do you believe that there is a potential for these systems to be used less safely, you know, if they're communicated a certain way? When you do investigate a crash, do you look at sort of potential HMI issues related to sort of how the company communicates about them, or are you really just looking at the crash itself?
We're going to be doing all of the above. So, for example, we know in the real world that very few people read their owner's manual. So if the automaker is depending on someone reading the owner's manual to use the automation correctly, that's probably a prescription for a problem. So that's probably not a reliable way to assume. And that's why we go back to the fundamental design phase, where if the automation should not be used in a certain way, then the design needs to make sure that it won't be used in a certain way, as opposed to depending on the driver having read the book and followed the book. And that's an example, again, of human-centric automation, as opposed to just automating because you can. So I can tell you, when I read my book, my owner's manual, and that's twice a year when I have to change the clock from daylight savings time and back because I don't know how to do the clock. So that's when I read my owner's manual. But I think very few people have ever really thoroughly read the owner's manual. And I think that to the extent that the automakers are depending on people reading the owner's manual to assume the automation is going to be used correctly, that is not a robust assumption.
Member Hart, what kind of car do you drive?
I have a Chevrolet Bolt.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, that is interesting. Does your Bolt have, obviously it has traction control, right? And ABS. Going back in time, there were stories, I remember as a kid when ABS was first instituted, of people thinking that because they had it, they were safer and therefore driving to the limits of the technology without understanding it. With the forward collision warning and automatic emergency braking systems, are you going to be making recommendations regarding, say, standardization of performance of these systems?
I don't happen to have those systems in my car, but we are. I mean, if you look again, going back to the automation in aviation, if you look to when information in the airplane, in the cockpit, about what the weather was nearby, what the airplanes are like nearby, what's the terrain like nearby, in other words, all of the things that you need to know to have situational awareness when you're flying, the concern was, I wonder if people will start flying in weather that is beyond their capability, because they now know they're not going to hit other airplanes and they're not going to hit the terrain, and so is that going to change their equation on when they should fly and when they shouldn't? I've heard that referred to as moving the moral compass, if you will, because of automation, and that is always a possibility, and that's one of the human factors issues that needs to be considered when things are being automated, is to what extent will this change behavior? So will the fact of having a seatbelt mean that you're going to drive more dangerously? Will the fact of having an airbag mean that you're going to drive more dangerously? Will the fact of having anti-lock brakes mean that you're going to drive faster in the snow because you're not concerned about skidding with your anti-lock brakes? The human reality is that, yes, oftentimes people do change their behavior to respond to the changes in the system that they're using.
So I know you're currently, the NTSB is currently investigating the Josh Brown crash with Tesla Autopilot. So we can't discuss the details of that case. But I was wondering if it was possible for you to share a few thoughts about this issue, sort of around the word autopilot when it comes to automobiles. I think there's been sort of a lot of debate among people in the Tesla community and the sort of the automated driving, autonomous drive technology community, sort of about whether or not autopilot, you know, really has a fixed meaning, whether that commonly understood meaning applies to automobiles in a specific and easy to understand way, or is it a source of confusion? Like I said, this has been a big broad debate. So if it's possible for you to sort of touch on this, maybe abstractly rather than specifically to the one accident that you're investigating, that I would be fascinated to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I would just say, as a general matter, this is my personal opinion, but as a general matter, the use of the term autopilot is misleading in cars, because in airplanes, when pilots fly an airplane with autopilot, they know that they are still necessary to the operation. I'm not sure that Joe Public has that understanding. So some people, when they see the word autopilot, are going to figure, well, I'm not needed here, so I don't need to engage. I think that's asking for trouble when you use a term that is ambiguous that way.
Most people know sort of what, in a very state to state, obviously, what it takes to get a driver's license. But could you just, for those who aren't familiar with aviation, talk a little bit about sort of what it takes to have a pilot's license, both in terms of the initial training, how much training it takes, and then in terms of ongoing fitness and assessment?
Well, what I'll address is the pilot's license in airliners, because that's really the basis of comparison that I'm using is the airline trade versus just general flying. And in airliners, the training is very intensive and it's recurrent. You have to come back, depending on the program you have, the pilots have to come back at least once a year for intense training, sometimes twice a year, depending on the circumstances. And there's intense ground school, there's flying in the simulators, there's flying in the airplane. The training is intense. And that's one of the major differences between airlines and cars, is that there is no such intense training in cars. And for most people, it's a one-time thing. You train. Train is actually the wrong word. You read the book and you figure out all you need to know in order to originally get your driver's license. And once you do that, there is no training as such. And as I said, reading the manual is not likely to happen. So there's a huge difference in the variability of skill in drivers versus the variability of skill in pilots. Pilots are highly trained and retrained and tested and extensively tested. And that's not happening in the car world.
If I recall correctly, was not Sperry, who invented the autopilot, wasn't he killed in an accident using it?
I don't know the answer to that. That's a good question.
Let me look that up while we're talking. But that is an interesting data point for anyone who has too much faith in words.
That would have been in probably the 1930s. So that goes back some time ago, and you know, when automation was in its very earliest infancy.
Your article also touches upon, I mean, it's primarily about safety, but it also talks about cybersecurity and safety. And you mentioned at the outset that the NTSB also investigates shipping accidents. There was recently the fourth naval accident. The Navy ship had an impact a couple of days ago. And there have been rumors that there may be a cybersecurity problem with naval vessels. Is there a history of cybersecurity issues affecting aircraft and shipping?
Cybersecurity is going to be a big issue, and it's going to be a bigger issue continuously because people are getting better at it. We have not yet seen any airplane crashes that have a cybersecurity element. I'm not aware of, I don't know enough about what's happening with those ships to know, you know, whether there's a cybersecurity issue there. But as a general matter, we would not, if someone used a hacking technique to get into a vehicle and cause the vehicle to crash, as a general matter, we would not investigate it because we don't investigate intentional wrongdoing. We only investigate accidents. So if that happened, we would call in the FBI, just as we did with 9/11, and the FBI would lead the investigation, and then we would provide technical expertise to the investigation. Having said that, there are several concerns that I have regarding cybersecurity in cars, and that is that the defenses against attacks are very robust in airplanes. That doesn't mean they're impenetrable. Sooner or later, somebody will penetrate them. We've already heard reports of people penetrating the entertainment system. I'm not aware of any confirmed reports that anybody has been able to get into the flight control system, but that's just a matter of time before someone figures that out. But the defenses are very robust, and the systems don't change very rapidly, so that once you have a robust system in there, you're not looking at having to create another robust system because of rapid changes in the automation. In the car world, I see a very different scenario. I see lots of pushing out of new software features over the air so that you don't have to take your car to the dealer, but you're getting the new software. And I'm wondering, to what extent is this new software tested for cybersecurity? I think there's going to be a huge opportunity for cybersecurity attacks if that happens. Again, we won't be investigating it because it'll be intentional. But here's what I do. Here's where I do see a potential problem that we would be investigating. And that is when you put a complicated cybersecurity operating system on top of a complicated operational system, I think there is a high likelihood of some interaction between those two systems, because the changes are coming out so rapidly that the robust testing of software that normally occurs in aviation won't have an opportunity to occur in autos. I think there's a huge opportunity that the interaction between the cybersecurity systems and the operational systems is going to create some unintended consequences that may result in crashes. So that would be where we would investigate.
This actually brings me to a question that I have yet to hear a really good answer. And I particularly want to ask you because, you know, of your role in investigating these issues. One of the key technologies that seems to be driving autonomous drive forward, especially sort of progress towards level 4 and level 5, is deep neural nets and these machine learning systems. And one of the major concerns that I hear from some people about them is that many of them are fundamentally a black box. In other words, you know, you can see the input that go into these neural nets. You can sort of look at the data sets that have been used to train them, and then you can see the result. But sort of the decision-making process is something that, you know, you don't always, in fact, often don't at all have any sort of visibility into. As an accident investigator, is this a concern for you? Is this something that maybe, you know, fears about are overblown? I think this sort of relates to what you were just talking about, but if you could address that specifically, that'd be great.
I'm not aware of any extensive amount of learning automation in aviation. So in your car, the automation is going to learn what your acceleration behavior is, what your braking behavior is. I'm not aware of any such learning automation in aviation, and therefore we don't have any investigative experience with it. As we do gain investigative experience with it, maybe because we see it in the car world, then we're going to have to respond appropriately. But at this point, I don't really have much to say about that because we haven't. It's too early for us to really comment on learning automation.
Is the NTSB reaching out to the high-tech community, or are you bringing new folks in that have some experience with machine learning and these sorts of systems to prepare for the future? Or what steps are you taking to sort of build up NTSB's ability to investigate these increasingly complex situations?
We've done a very good job of maintaining the skills in-house, either by training or by new people, to keep us up to date with the automation world, again, mostly in aviation, because that's where we see it the most. And we will continue to do that as the needs demand. One of the areas that we're getting a huge increase in is the availability of information from a lot of sources that were not generated in order to help accident investigation. So, for example, in your car, you have an airbag chip. You have an analog brake chip. You have an automatic engine control. A lot of that information is non-volatile, which means it doesn't disappear when you lose the power source, so that when we get there after a crash, we can go to that airbag chip and that brake chip and the engine control chip, and we can learn a lot about what was happening to the car that wasn't otherwise available to us. So we're getting a huge increase in that capability as we are in aviation. So, for example, with glass cockpits, a lot of those glass cockpits have non-volatile information sources that we can draw upon that were not designed for accident investigation, but that are very useful for us in that respect nonetheless.
In the case of the Tesla accident, the car stores some amount of data on board, and then there's some data that's stored in their cloud. As every manufacturer is now talking about moving data to the cloud and uploading data, do you anticipate that there will need to be some kind of legislation to make it possible for an accident investigation to access 100% of the data of the car regarding the car's behavior prior to an accident? Because right now it seems like it's not possible to get that data easily.
That will depend on how the manufacturers engage with us if we're there investigating an accident in one of their vehicles. I would say that in this accident, again, the Tesla accident is coming to public hearing on September 12th, but I would say that our experience has been that Tesla has been very, very cooperative with us in providing the information that we need, even though, well, I should say especially because most of it was not accessible by us until without their help. So they had to be there to help us get to that information, and they have been very cooperative in providing what we needed.
moving outside, maybe outside of the NTSB's purview, there's debate over whether infrastructure external to autonomous vehicles is necessary in order to achieve level 4 or level 5, you know, VIDA X systems like such and such. Can you state an opinion as to whether you believe level 4 and 5 autonomy is possible with or without external infrastructure?
I don't really have the expertise to do that, but I would say that in one of the directions that they're pursuing in aviation is to enable airplanes to know where other airplanes are. So the V2V type information so that vehicles can communicate and know where other vehicles are, and the V2I kind of communication, both of those are being developed extensively in aviation and are proving to be quite useful. So I would be surprised if the same doesn't happen with cars.
You also mentioned at the outset that you're a pilot. And so what kind of aircraft do you fly?
I mostly fly Cessnas, Pipers, Beaches, but I've also got quite a bit of time in business jets, because when I was at the FAA, they have a fleet of business jets that they keep at National Airport for VIP transport, and I did a lot of flying in those business jets. So I have extensive experience in quite a few airplanes. I even have an hour and a half or two in the A380, for example, because when I went to Toulouse, they are proud of how pilot-friendly their airplanes are. So when I went to Toulouse, they let me fly it because they knew of my, 3,000 hours of flying, and so I flew in the simulator, and they were confident from that I could fly the real airplane. So the next day I flew the real airplane. So I do have, an hour and a half or two in the A380, but most of my time is in smaller airplanes, including quite a bit of time in small business jets.
And how much face time or interaction have you had with people at automotive manufacturers who are developing autonomous systems?
Very little, because very little of our work is in the automotive realm. Most of our highway crash investigations have been large trucks, large buses with professional drivers. So, Joe or Susie Public with their car has not really been a focus of most of our investigations until now.
The reason I ask is because everyone I know who's a pilot drives a car, and yet very few of the people developing autonomous technologies for cars are familiar with aviation systems. And that, to me, seems so negligent. It's shocking.
What you say is the reason why, when I gave a speech on this subject at the National Press Club on June 30th of 2016, I guess it was last year, that speech was all about how much experience the NTSB has investigating automation accidents and how we would be a valuable source of information to the auto industry regarding their development of automation so they don't make those same mistakes over again. That's, of course, the subject of the article. But since then, I am not aware of any systematic efforts on the part of the industry to come to us and learn from our accident investigation experience.
It seems like an absolute shocking oversight that so many billions are being invested without people, reaching out to the NTSB, to the aviation industry, to learn more about what's been learned over 40, 50 years.
Well, I can't speak to how much they've reached out to the aviation industry. I can just say that I am not aware of any reach out to us in terms of our accident investigation experience.
You also mentioned that you were the acting chairman of the NTSB. What is your next step in terms of working with the automotive sector?
Well, that's a good question. My term as member expires at the end of this calendar year, December 31st. And after that, I'm going to have to decide what I want to do when I grow up. So, that's a good question. I haven't got an answer to that at this point.
I just have a quick question. I mean, there's this big open question, right, about autonomous cars, especially level 4, level 5. How safe is safe enough? Is it enough for these vehicles to be safer than the average human, or what have you? And so NHTSA tends to look at this, and regulators, and certainly the companies that are developing them, sort of in this broad statistical view, right, of over, how many millions of miles does it take to come to a reasonable conclusion about the level of safety? How does it compare to human-driven vehicles and all that? But NTSB, it seems like you guys, rather than sort of looking at necessarily the big picture, you guys are investigating, very specific incidents and what goes wrong in that incident. Are you concerned that at some point, these systems will become so good that you'll be out of a job? Or will there always be room to make these systems safer? And do you have any thoughts sort of on, as an accident investigator, about whether there even is a point at which it's safe enough? Or will this improvement sort of potentially be ongoing, forever?
safety can always be improved, and the airline, the aviation experience is a great example of that. They've been automating for decades, and they still don't completely have their hands around it. There will never be perfect automation, so there's always room for improvement, and that I'm sure that's going to be the case with cars as well. The recent accident, well, not recent anymore, Air France from Rio to Paris is just a textbook poster child on the fact that the industry does not completely have its hands around the human automation interface, and that accident had that I referred to in the article had so many aspects to it of, you know, advanced automation and complacency and skills degradation and not understanding the system and never seeing that failure before, even in training. Kind of, there are lots of issues there that reflect that reality that automation will never be perfect. And it will always fail at some time sooner or later. We stopped saying 100 years ago, this ship can't sink. So we know that it can always, there's always an opportunity for failure. So there will always be room for improvement. And even in aviation, after they've been doing it for decades, I know that's going to be the case with respect to cars as well.
And it seems like a lot of that improvement is not necessarily just technological, but a lot of it seems to be understanding the human factors and sort of understanding human psychology and sort of how to make, not necessarily how to just make the systems more capable in and of themselves, but how to make them, integrate them more with the human aspect of the system. Is that a fair conclusion?
Yeah, actually, I would say that's most of the challenge. The challenge of preventing failures, the aviation world has done a very good job of either preventing failures or making sure that if a failure occurs, that the operator is advised of it soon enough to take over successfully. And that's why my article does not include any accidents in aviation involving automation failures, because I couldn't come up with any. On the other hand, I had quite a few accidents regarding automation that didn't respond to the human factors and that didn't respond to successfully to unanticipated circumstances. So those are those two challenges, the human factors and the unanticipated circumstances. Those are the tough parts. The failure part is relatively easy. That's a challenge in and of itself, but that's relatively easy compared to figuring out how to address the human factors and figuring out how to address the unanticipated circumstances.
So if folks are out there maybe in academia or something like that, maybe one of the takeaways from this, and I think frankly some of the other conversations we have, is that if you're in psychology or human factor study or behavior or other sorts of what some might consider more soft sciences rather than the sort of technical sciences that most people associate with autonomous drive technology, your research is just as important or potentially maybe even more important to continually improving the safety of these systems than maybe even, you know, folks who are just doing sensor work or processing work or things like that. Is that fair?
The human part of the challenge is by far going to be the toughest part of the challenge, yes. The technology of it is relatively easy to implement and do successfully. The human element is the tough part to incorporate.
As someone with more of a social science background, this really warms my heart, because sometimes it does seem like the conversation is completely dominated by folks on the hard science technical side. So that's really great to hear, and I really hope folks take your words seriously and find new sort of human centric ways to contribute to automotive safety going forward.
You'll have a job for a long time to come, I assure you.
I have one more question, because I know we're coming up on an hour. You talk at length about the Sullenberger event in your article. There is a book called Fly By Wire. Are you familiar with it?
No, I'm not.
In the book Fly By Wire, which is basically a history of the Airbus flight envelope protection system framed by the Sullenberger landing, it suggests that because he was in an Airbus, that the Airbus automation relieved the aircrew of certain tasks, like the pitch angle, and allowed them to, I guess, divert their energies to locating a safe place to land. Which kind of suggests that had they been in a Boeing, that they might not have been able to land safely. I asked Sullenberger whether that's true. Whether had he been in a Boeing, that might have had a different outcome, and he didn't really answer the question. Do you have an opinion on this?
I'm not confident that there would have been a different outcome either. In fact, I can think of some. There was an automation aspect to Sullenberger's accident, and it's not widely known. But I don't want to go into the technical details. But when he was about to land in the water, he's doing what's called a flare, which means pulling the nose up to reduce the vertical speed so that you would impact at the minimum speed. So that's what you always do when you land, and that's what he was doing when he was approaching the water, to pull the nose up to minimize the vertical impact speed. Some of the automation in the airplane that was still active, because he did the right thing by energizing the auxiliary power unit, which provided the power to keep the automation running. So some of the automation was still in effect as he was doing that approach. And because of that automation, it prevented him from going, from taking the airplane as nose up as he wanted to. In particular, he wanted to go as far as he could without stalling, but the automation prevented him from getting the last 3.5 degrees of nose up angle of attack that he was relying on to try to minimize the vertical impact speed. So we're wondering to this day, if he had been able to get that extra 3.5 degrees of nose up, would the fuselage have breached as it did when he impacted the water? And would that vertical member, that vertical strut, have gone through the floor and injured the flight attendant the way it did? So there are some automation aspects even to that accident, and I am not confident. In fact, I would say the other way around, because Sully is such a superbly trained and qualified pilot. I seriously doubt if he would have stalled it, even if it had been a Boeing airplane. And I wonder if he would have had that limitation on the last 3.5 degrees of nose up alpha if he had been in a Boeing. I don't know the answer to that, but I guess I'm saying what Sully did, which is that he's not sure that the outcome would have been different. I'm not sure that the outcome would have been different either.
Well, I have one last fun question for you, and then we can wrap this up. Do you believe that there is some positive, cathartic, maybe, you know, psychological benefit to humans being in control of machines? Or is automation, is it a zero-sum game? Automation is good and people should derive no benefit from being in control of agency and outcomes.
Well, that's kind of a psychological question. I'm not sure I'm an expert to answer that, but I would say that to the extent that automation is in place and people don't feel necessary, there's a danger, because in an environment where people are still necessary, as they are in airplanes. In fact, when people ask me, how soon will it be before I get on an airliner that has no pilot? My answer is Sully, because if he had not been in that airplane, I don't think we would have seen that outcome. So, you know, whether there's a sort of a psychological assurance benefit, I'm not qualified to say. I would say that pilots like it because automation generally takes care of the tactical things while they can do more of the strategic issues. That's one of the benefits of automation. But having said that, we know from horrible experience that when automation is so good that pilots don't have to do very much, that we know that humans do not make good monitors, and that if their only job is to monitor the automation to make sure it's working right and to be immediately prepared to take over if they have to, that's an equation for disaster, because we have seen too many examples where that didn't work. So it's hard to, I guess, characterize it as a catharsis, but I would finish where I started. I would say that automation is a double-edged sword. It has its positive aspects, but getting there ain't as easy as people think.
That's a great way to end it.
Yeah. We'd just like to say, be sure to check out Member Hart's piece about all this, which will be published at thedrive.com. We will be sure to tweet the link via Twitter. And we will hopefully be able to get that up in the episode description on our website, which is autonicast.com. Member Hart, thank you so much for making the time to speak with us today. This has been a really fascinating perspective on some of these issues. So again, thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. It's fascinating to me, too. And I look forward to the opportunity to participate in it even more, especially after I leave the NTSB.
Absolutely.
I'd like to add, Member Hart, that I'm very excited and curious to what you're going to do next, because your voice here on the Autonicast and in your article is exactly what is missing from the dialogue as autonomous vehicles approach in a serious way. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Ed, where can we find you online?
I am at on Twitter at tweetermeyer.com. I'm sorry, on Twitter at Tweetermeyer. That's where you can find me.
And I am AlexRoy144 on pretty much all platforms.
All right. Well, that wraps it up for us. Thank you for spending another hour with us at the Autonicast. We will be back soon with more guests and more episodes. So stay tuned. Thank you.